Essential concepts. In this segment, we examine a number of concepts and ideas in some depth, as they form the building blocks for much that comes afterwards. We hope to ensure for all students a common understanding of some of the words that will be used, because people are only able to communicate one with another in a highly symbolic form, and there is no point in going a long way into the course before discovering that we need a better common understanding of the terms used. Words, the symbols of meaning, are enormously important in arriving at the correct relationships in society and in achieving freedom potentials. The first word that we would like to examine is the word philosophy. This word probably turns off more minds than almost any other in the English language, because it's normally followed by extremely difficult, if not impossible, conceptually abstract language, in which most of us are lost in a comparatively short period of time. I don't think many of us are greatly encouraged either by the encyclopedic portraits of the so-called philosophers over the ages, because they all seem to have long, flowing beards and exceedingly dry demeanours. Nevertheless, a philosophy is something which we all have, which none of us can escape, and which guides our every act and deed. At the very simplest level, a philosophy is a concept of reality. A concept of reality may be true, that is, a correct concept of reality, or it may be false and an incorrect concept of reality. There are true philosophies or concepts of reality, and there are incorrect ones. However, true or false, we are all compelled, at the risk of our lives, to come to grips with reality in our minds, and as we attempt to do so, we form philosophies. No doubt the most common statement with respect to philosophy is that famous quote from Shakespeare's Hamlet, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are ever dreamed of in your philosophy." We can all relax. A philosophy is simply a concept of reality. It may not be terribly sophisticated at all. Nevertheless, we all carry and obey, and periodically, upon experience, amend our philosophy, and with a little judgment, we grow in wisdom. To give an example, a man who holds in his hand a bottle of fine pink crystals, neatly labelled icing sugar, and who believes this label implicitly, and treats the pink crystals as icing sugar, will, if those pink crystals are indeed strychnine, be killed quite as surely by spreading them on his cake as if he were deliberately attempting suicide. With philosophies, things are often other than they seem. The human mind is able to label and compartmentalize our knowledge of things. When we thus categorize things, it can be useful in hypothesizing about them. However, a man's philosophy does not in any jot or tittle affect the reality that is outside of himself. Reality is the great disciplinarian which compels us sometimes on pain of death to get our philosophy right. One of the things that people find most inhibiting about becoming involved in discussions about philosophy is that there seems to be at least several thousand, if not hundreds of thousands of the jolly things. They seem to be everywhere. They arise out of every dust-gathering tome in the great libraries of the world. Even our neighbours and our friends seem to have invented several of their own. But this is not a useful or correct way of considering philosophy. Philosophy is a concept of reality, and it can be categorised under just two headings, those that are true and those that are the false concepts of reality. Accurate concepts of reality, those which do precisely and accurately reflect the reality which is, are true. Everything other than this is false. So that really there is no need to be confused by millions of philosophies. There are only two philosophies under heaven, the true philosophy and the false philosophy. Certainly there is an infinite variety to falsehood. While the concept that 2 units plus 2 units equals 4 units is, or ought to be, part of your philosophy or concept of reality in the universe, if you happen to hold an incorrect concept, then the answer you give may range from 7 to 0 to infinity to oblivion to the 10th power. But really, all of the confusion of that abates once we bring considerations back to truth and falsehood. There are some aspects of the difference between the false and the true philosophy which must be confronted right at the outset of the pursuit of freedom, because they are relevant even to the very definition of what freedom is. Perhaps the most important consideration initially is the one as to the origin of power. Does political power arise from a point within or a point outside of the individual? This question raises a number of important issues. For instance, does power reside in some abstraction of society? And what is the primary important entity in society? These are absolute watersheds in determining every person's attitude to freedom potentials. The Christian faith, by proclaiming that salvation is personal, maintains that God works through the individual. And yet, this is a relatively and certainly revolutionary recent concept at variance with the tribalism of our past. There was, at the time of Christ, and before and also since, plenty of evidence of those who rejected the internal personal source of political power. These people are at times known as Nazis, who believe that salvation is collective through a super race. They are sometimes known as communists, who believe that the salvation of the world must come through another collectivity, an historically inevitable class, which comes to dictatorship through the state. Again, it may be expressed as some tribal collectivism, as with Pharisaical tribalism, which insisted upon social elevation because of their descent from Abraham. Whatever the collective entity is, which is perceived to be the one of foremost importance, it will inevitably lead on to totalitarianism. If it is some class or race or any other collectivity of whatever nature which is perceived to be of the greatest importance, then the individual's role shall only take on an importance in relation to that individual's value or disservice to that collective entity. It is no longer a matter of morality if some abstract collectivity is elevated above the individual. In such a system, an individual's worth and the relevance of his actions can only be seen or judged correctly in relationship to the well-being of the collectivity. It's then a case, ultimately, of total power to the collectivity, totalitarianism, as opposed to maximum freedom for the individual with appropriate responsibility, democracy. Prior to Christ, the attitude of almost all men who exercised political power was one in which they saw themselves as serving an abstraction. It may have been a Greek city-state, a Pharisaical legal system, or the tribe. They viewed the individual in terms of his or her usefulness in serving this abstraction. The politically revolutionary message brought by Christ is presented in his statement that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. This said that the Sabbath, the most sacred of Pharisaical institutions, was instituted as a service to men, and that men were not created to serve even that sacred institution. Christ emphasized this again and again, and told his disciples and others that even he came to minister, not to be ministered unto. Even Christ, who was seen by his disciples as the living God, had adopted service as his normal way of life. For him, authority was the power and mandate to serve others. He also stated that, "He who would be the greatest among you, let him be the servant of all." The conflict that immediately grew up between the Pharisees and Christ, and later the Roman Empire and the Christian Church, centered much more around the state's political hunger for power than with religious considerations. It's quite obvious that Christ saw the position of the Roman Emperor as an often flaunted opportunity to serve rather than a position of self-centered personal gratification. This thinking, when articulated by Christ and the Church, was fighting talk, and for this the persecutions were intense and prolonged, going beyond that meted out to any other religious viewpoint of the time. Other religious viewpoints then in Rome could be easily accommodated into the then current view of the God Emperor, which reduced all men to his servants. So the question as to whether power arises in some abstraction of society, and as to what is the primarily important entity in society, is an absolute watershed in determining every person's attitude to freedom potentials. All manner and measure of matters are decidedly influenced by these considerations. For instance, even at an ethical level, those who see personal salvation and the individual as being the proper object of the service of all organizational structure will also acknowledge their own personal responsibility for self-discipline and service more readily. During times of the highest ethical standards in the West, such concepts as that of the gentleman and the ethical man, who, through self-discipline, had perceived his own interests as being extended to embrace fair play, honourable conduct, the respect of women, the rights of others, and much, much more, were developed. Conversely, with those who sought the elevation of an abstract collectivity, attention and effort were directed increasingly to concentrating power in the hands of that entity, or at least in the name of that entity. Russian government in the 1940s was in the hands of the dictatorship of Joseph Stalin, under the name of a collectivity which the population, at least in an initial period, was deceived into believing could help and deliver them. The reality was different. The reality was that no such entity as the proletariat class had ever lived. There was simply no such animal. Its existence as an entity that could operate as such was mostly confined within the brains of its followers. That is not to say that there was not, or is not, a large number of people primarily dependent upon employment for their income, who may be categorized broadly as the working class. This concept partakes of truth. However, the elevation of that concept brings with it a large deceit. Of course, the interests of the working class can be advanced where each individual member of that class is able to make decisions in the light of their own interests and without undue pressure. Those of the freedom philosophy seeking to advance the conditions of the working class seek to advance the interests of every individual working person. The elevation of the collectivity to the point where it can dictate to everybody, while the power of millions of individuals is overruled, is quite tyrannical. Nevertheless, this approach has preoccupied, misled, and deceived a great many people, at least for a short period of time. Once one has examined and accepted this concept of how power and the most important entity in society ought to be considered, then many other things come into focus. For instance, it is no longer possible to see communists and Nazis as diametrically opposed, with one presumably on the left and the other on the right. Both believe in a collective entity whose importance transcends all else. Both believe in the complete subordination of the individual to the service of that abstract entity. The fact that they are different entities is, in the final analysis, unimportant. Many were amazed at the close of the Second World War to observe high Nazi officials in East Germany readily, sincerely, adopting communism, which had previously been thought of as their greatest enemy. All they were doing was shifting their affections from one collective falsity to another. This is a much easier undertaking than reversing the way one considers power in society. It is easier to capitulate to another collectivity than to transform the collective entity into a structure for genuine service which serves the individual. The next two words to which we would like to direct your attention are the words policy and administration. Policy shares a derivation with words like politics and police, and it is related to the word power. Policy grows outwards from philosophy, and it can be most simply defined as a bias as to the result required. Every philosophy or concept of reality gives rise to a policy or bias as to the result required. To reduce it to its simplest terms, for example, if it is your concept of reality that apples are especially good for your health, then that will give rise to a bias as to the result you require, that is, a policy of apple pie. Administration has to do with how to get it. And you will often have noticed that the policy of apple pie, once determined in a restaurant, does not involve you in any way with the question of how to get it. The waiter or proprietor of a restaurant does not plague you with, how do I get the apples, and should the pastry be obtained hither and yon, or baked thus or so. The policy or expression of the desired result, apple pie, was yours. The ministering to your policy is the function of your servants, the staff of the restaurant. It is extremely important to understand the precise difference between policy and administration, because in this we will discover the limitations of democracy. This distinction will also help to ensure that democracy is not denied in practice. There was once a small rural community who lived in and centered around a village on a major river. This river was given to periodic flooding, and therefore the community was generally severed in two several times a year, often with little or no notice, and this proved extremely disruptive to social and business activity. One day the politician came to town, and since the river wasn't in flood at the time, the whole town assembled to discuss the problem. As the politician stepped onto the stage, he was met with a tremendous roar and a clear, precise message. We want a bridge, we want a bridge, we want a bridge. Now, the politician, perceiving this, could see that there was no prospect of him arguing, that they didn't really want a bridge after all. So, when he arose, he said, yes, I've got the message. I've already got it 100% clear. Tell me if I'm wrong. You want a bridge. Of course, they all shouted assent. Well then, said the politician, and this is where we see the change from people dictating policy to being tempted beyond policy into administration. The politician said, yes, yes, you want a bridge, but tell me, what sort of bridge do you want? Do you want a wooden bridge? And there were several people who thought, yes, a timber bridge would be excellent. The district had some high-quality hardwood. It could create local employment. It would help local businesses, and there was considerable support for a wooden bridge. He then said, would you prefer a steel bridge? Many of the community then rose to observe that, well, yes, white ants and dry rot and other parasites and fungi could seriously affect the future of our bridge, and a steel bridge could offer greater permanency. While it had the disadvantage of less local employment, on balance it would be the one they would favour. But of course, that wasn't the end of the administrative discussion. There was another point of view, which was that a pre-stressed concrete bridge was the best type. And even though it would mean very little local employment and all the material would have to come from outside the district, this was definitely the best way to go. Then, having been so foolish as to involve themselves deeply in administrative matters, that community divided into three separate parts, or as parts are generally called in political matters, parties. We had a concrete bridge party, we had a steel bridge party, and we had a timber bridge party. The relative merits of structures that were susceptible to rust and concrete cancer and termites, and all of those other considerations that bore upon the difficulties of administering the construction of bridges, were discussed into the night without any conclusion. Nobody even noticed that the politician in the midst of this had quietly stepped off the stage, and after a time had walked to the back of the hall, and in due course had moved on and left the area. You see, we need to remember that the only prerogative of democracy is to determine policy. Policy, as we defined it, is the bias as towards the result required. Democracy is extremely well suited to determining what people want. Since in a free society, the objective of and purpose for human association is to serve the individual, then democracy is impossible without regular and accurate expressions of policy from the people of what they want. At this stage, democracy has reached its natural limit. From there on, how to achieve the bridge or the apple pie or whatever it is that people want has to be, especially in an advancing society, technologically of increasing complexity, a matter for the expert. The expert's function is purely administrative. His role is simply to give the people what they want. The expert, therefore, must be on tap and not on top. We have tyranny when the experts decide what the people want. When the expert is on tap and available to be made use of, in order that his expertise may be used to deliver what is determined by others, then we have a properly ordered democratic society. Administration might be expressed diagrammatically as a pyramid, at the apex of which is an individual charged with overall responsibility. Depending upon the results he delivers, he should be hired, fired, promoted, or demoted. Under this person, who has overall administrative responsibility, we find others who are directed explicitly as to their role, function, and purpose in the overall activity. Administration, or how to do it, has always been a matter of hierarchical direction. In a totalitarian society, every effort is made to reduce everything to a matter of administration. All of society is seen simply as a pyramid, with a dictator at the apex, with the great mass of people at or near the base, and a few scrambling to stand on others' shoulders halfway up the pyramid. In a free society, administration is still hierarchical, and still diagrammatically expressed as a pyramid, in which there is a clear chain of command and responsibility. However, outside of this pyramid, encircling it, there are free individuals, freely associating together to direct the administration as to the results required. Means and mechanisms of doing this will be examined through the following segments. However, some obvious controls exist in the political vote and the rights of consumers in a free economy to choose or reject products and services. The basis of freedom has already been defined by your lecturer as the right to choose or refuse one thing at a time. An essential element in maintaining your freedom resides in your right to contract out. The Soviet Union would long ago have been forced to abandon its totalitarian approach had it not been able to prevent its citizens from contracting out. This was achieved through constructing the Iron Curtain, and it has successfully prevented the victims of totalitarianism from escaping, with only those of especially privileged groups of people being allowed to immigrate. However, this has not prevented the decline of the USSR, because there are more ways of contracting out than choking yourself with butter, to mix metaphors. Simply a lower level of cooperation in industrial, economic, and commercial enterprise is enough to sicken anybody politic over a longer term. It's a great mistake to suppose that any situation can ultimately be maintained in which the individual cannot contract out. The donkey may be described as an ass, but nevertheless, when he contracts out and he lays down in harness, the strongest and most determined of men resort firstly to rage, secondly to violence, and in the end to impotent tears, because nothing under heaven can shift a donkey who has jacked up. The more committed an individual is to what is known as the social contract, and therefore the more useful and dedicated an individual is to serving others, the greater the reticence to contract out. However, as the old adage observes, even the worm will turn, and in the end, nothing can prevent a totalitarian society from degenerating economically, socially, culturally, and politically as individuals progressively lose faith in it.
The next word to discuss here is the word association. Man is a social being. By that it is meant that man, unlike the hermit crab or the leopard, is a being of wide social interaction and contact, as are many of the animal kingdom. In the economic sphere, our associations are generally more easily recognized as being most extensive. A man who spends his life in the simplest task of mending potholes in the road will certainly bring benefit to every person in his community. So it is with thousands of occupational tasks. Mutual benefit is the motive force behind association, and in order to maintain this, people have invented rules. Rules can expand our freedom as well as protect it. Road rules are an obvious example. Without them, our freedom to drive and travel and to communicate would be most hazardous. Other rules, such as contract law, also play an essential part in maintaining the concept of mutual benefit in social and economic arrangements. Rules in a cultural and sporting context often constitute the game itself. Cricket, without rules, would simply be a ball, a piece of wood, and three sticks. The rules are the game, and the game is the rules, and no rules means no cricket. Now let us suppose that a number of people come together and to decide to form a golf club. These people have decided to associate together in order that through association they can all achieve the one objective in common, which is not within their reach as individuals. These individuals have adopted a common policy. That policy, which is purely to do with the results, is that the facilities to play golf shall be available to all the members. To do this, some rules are necessary, and in the case of golf itself, they are those most troublesome eight words: the ball shall be played where it lays. The golf club, the design and the maintenance of the course, shall have to be administered, and therefore to fulfil the policy to play golf, an administration is appointed. If, however, the administration, who had been hired for their professional competence and not for their interest in golf, decided that since they were rather more interested in tennis and they were in command of the club administration, that now the membership should leave their golf clubs at home and bring their tennis rackets. At this point, there would be the most explosive outrage. This is justly so, because the membership's one right, which is absolutely sacrosanct, is that they, and they alone, in associating with each other, establish the policy, and is the policy in this case is definitely golf. At this stage, the membership must look to sanctions. If, through neglect or carelessness or a lack of rules or club constitution, effective sanctions are not available to force compliance to the policy, then the last resort is to contract out. One then resigns one membership and votes with one's feet. The correct rules of human association apply just as absolutely to government as they do to the golf club. Neglect of these rules at the level of government is serious. The numbers of people affected is obviously great, but so also is the extent to which the government affects these lives. Another word which needs attention is authority. There is considerable latitude in attitude as to what the correct relationship with authority is. It can be properly described as power with responsibility. Not just power, but power with responsibility. There is the natural authority which is acquired, for example, by a potato grower who has grown his potatoes for 20 years in a particular soil type in a particular district. If this man is successful, and this is evidenced by his peers' attitude to him, then this man has authority in respect to his chosen area of expertise. This is not to say that authorities are always right, or that they invariably make the right decisions. What it does mean is that opinion carries the weight of experience and responsibility in that area and is therefore worthy of more consideration than the opinion of others. There is considerable discussion, even in Christian circles, about the correct attitude to authority. On the one hand, Scripture commands that we respect and obey authority, and on the other hand, it says that we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and wickedness in high places. These two concepts are not in conflict. Respect for authority, when properly defined as power with responsibility, is only a way of respecting one's genuine servants. Respect for a policeman, who is lawfully maintaining the law of the people, is the same thing as respect for the rights of a free society to make rules for its own freedom and protection. Respect for authority is the correct policy. However, this does not extend to respecting any bandit who has seized power and who ruthlessly and without accountability decrees as he wishes. People like this are not exercising authority, but brute power, and your obligation to respect them is therefore negated. Another term that will be used during this school is social credence. The word social denotes association and refers to the human association that we have already discussed, while the word credence comes from the Latin credo, I believe. What this term denotes is the belief which is inherent in the individuals in society that people can, through associating together, achieve the results they require. It is the common belief that policy is attainable. Social credence is the true cement of all association, and where it is destroyed in a cricket club or in a nation, that association is doomed, or at least will decline to the extent that social faith or credence has been shaken or undone. Where an association genuinely serves the needs of its members, then that credence grows, and the spirit of that association will grow and prosper. In military association, Napoleon spoke of morale, which is to all other factors as 10 is to 1. Morale is maintained through the anticipation and the attainment of a common, worthwhile objectives. It is not possible for a human being to be without social credence. Certainly, the level of social credence may vary a great deal from one individual to another. However, any persons who maintain that they have no social credit portray themselves as faithless and as having no use or purpose or interest in common with any other human beings. Experiences of good associations compel us again and again to credit benefits to human association. Yet, when it is betrayed, and betrayed repeatedly, it diminishes and accelerates towards social death. We spend time discussing this reality because one of the greatest prospects for service that any of us shall be offered is that of assisting the growth of social credence. It is this cement, this faith, this confidence which assists the power of love to overwhelm the love of power. When we look at the social order of a beehive or an ant's nest, we are amazed at its extraordinary complexity. We tend, however, to think of human society, with which we are more familiar as being anything but extraordinary. The truth is that human society is of stupendous complexity. For the purposes of this course, we approach considerations of society in three broad categories. Human activity is divided into economics, government, and culture. Within these areas, all human activity takes place. In the economic realm, we organize all those necessary material things. This activity begins in attaining food and then clothing and shelter, but it is not wholly confined to these areas, as the needs of government and cultural activities also have a material aspect. Man's economic activity is not purely creative in that we begin with a world of abundance. Man's economic role to adapt and change existing matter into a more useful form, usually by applying available energy. The importance of economics is in the material production, which includes services. It is not, as we shall show in later segments, instituted for the purpose of keeping us busy, or in other words, fully employed. Government has to do with the way in which power is used. Its purpose is security with freedom. One of the most demanding questions is how to organize power so that it serves the individual's genuine interest while protecting the rights of others. Considerable time will be spent in examining such concepts as representation, democracy, parliaments, courts and executives, judiciaries, legislations, regulations, the rule of law, the vote, parties, the constitution, the crown, referendum, and much else. Finally, there is the third broad heading, the cultural area of activity. The true purpose of all cultural undertaking is self-development. We enjoy it because we believe that it is really the thing that we ought to be doing. It covers such activities as sports, music, the arts, church activities, and all affairs of the spirit. It explains at times extraordinary behavior, such as where an individual will row out to sea in the hot sun and return several hours later with two pathetic tiddlers, and will tell you that he had an absolutely marvelous time. This is explained by the fact that the activity was generally perceived by that individual as being the most important thing for him to be doing at that time. The inactivity of the fishing was an attraction rather than a drawback, because he sought to wind down his involvement with his high level of conscious mental activity. He tries to draw from his deeper springs and from his deeper being in order to consider many matters which are critical to the direction of his life. Other people seek self-worth through sports or the arts, and yet others simply recognize that it is in the simple things of the soul, such as music and poetry, that joy is more readily available. The cultural and spiritual area of life is the creative area, because in it we create ourselves, our values, our service to others, our ideals, and our self-development. Our fresh discovery of truth comes from this area of our lives. In culture, we refresh ourselves, and this knowledge is reflected in the word recreation, recreation. In cultural and spiritual activities, we are remade, recreated, refreshed, and reborn.